Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. I'm Leslie Hertig, Artistic Director, and I'm very happy to share this conversation featuring master storyteller Malcolm Gladwell in conversation with CBC Vancouver radio personality Lisa Christensen. This event was recorded live on October 3rd, 2019 at the Orpheum Theatre in Vancouver. Special thanks to our event sponsors, the Vancouver Foundation and UBC Library. The Vancouver Writers' Fest carries out its work, including this event you're about to listen to, on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This event features acclaimed journalist, author, and podcaster Malcolm Gladwell speaking about his new book, Talking to Strangers.
Well, this is very fun. Hello, everyone. I promised I was going to wave to certain people, and I don't see where you are, but hello. So thank you so much for coming this evening. I'm very excited. I have had a chance to now become best friends with our, guest here tonight. So we kind of worked out this new introduction because I had a whole bunch of notes and things you probably already know. In fact, I just stole it from this book, which you're all going to buy. So you can read it again there. So I thought I would just start by saying that we do have one of my new best friends here. And I'll tell Malcolm what that entails later. But I think we can go with one little bit of biographical information that I quite like. On if you look at Malcolm's Twitter bio, it says, skinny Canadian. His new book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And welcome, Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know what I'm doing with the pillow yet. Great. It feels really cozy, though, doesn't it?
You're wrestling with it.
I think I'll just kind of do a side thing here like that. Is that okay?
Is that how this evening is going to go?
Yeah.
I'm working on the pillow.
Yeah, well, you move it around if you need to, or if you want to put your feet up later. So, well, thank you so much for joining us. This is a great honor, quite exciting. You haven't even been to Vancouver that many times, you were saying.
Like four or five times. I'm an Eastern Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Few of them here.
I'm old enough to remember the famous thing you're not as old as I am, so you may not remember this. What the Premier of Alberta famously said about people from Ontario, let the Eastern bastards freeze in the dark. Remember that? I was one of those who froze in the dark.
Oh. Well, welcome to the West. Welcome back to the West. Good to have you here. That's what we like to call our hospitality. Actually, I do hear that a lot. I mean, I know there's obviously people from all over the place, but that Vancouver is particularly cold and it's hard to make friends. And I know you and I are already friends, so that's lucky for you.
We bonded backstage.
We bonded backstage.
Well, we have a kind of weird... You are... obsessed in the same way I am obsessed with my friend Dave Hill.
Yeah, Dave Hill, I know. Oh.
One person.
Okay, I was trying to tell you to come and perform, tell Dave to come here and perform, but I think we're going to have to work on this.
Dave, to be clear, is someone who lives in my neighborhood in New York and who we share a coffee shop, and he used to sell that in an apartment for my friend. And he's a metal god.
Yeah.
He's an incredible guitarist, and he's the leader of a kind of tongue-in-cheek metal band with the greatest metal band name. Well, said it was not the greatest metal band name of all time.
Well, only because I have my own fake metal band name that his, I think is better. But
his band is called, ready?
Yeah.
Witch Taint.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can't get...
You can follow them on Twitter, I do. So find them, Witch Taint.
You can't get more metal. You can't get more... I use, if you listen to my podcast, you know that I rely on Dave an extraordinary amount.
Yeah.
He's sort of a genius.
Well, it was very helpful for you. I mean, a lot of people don't know the difference between black and death metal, and that's an unfortunate thing that's happened in our society because people don't care about important things anymore.
And then I used him on a podcast that I did about in defense of Pat Boone.
Yes.
And
which was hard to make the...
That was the Pat... You may not have bought that argument. But that was
I did not.
You didn't buy it.
No, I did not.
That was the one where I was saying that Pat Boone was like Taco Bell. And then I had a long discussion that opened the episode with Dave Hill about Pat Boone's famous album of heavy metal covers.
Yeah, I think if you watch The Osbournes, any fans of the reality show The Osbournes, it always opened with Pat Boone's cover of Crazy Train.
Which is...
Which is... It's something. Yeah, it's...
What's hilarious about that is I did that episode, which was, I mean, it was so tongue-in-cheek that, like, I mean, I can't even... It was so meta that it was...
Yeah.
It was turning on its... And I couldn't even figure out, like, whether I was serious or not by the end of it. But what happened after it ran? So this is this long defense of Pat Boone saying he was not a cultural appropriator because of all, you know, in the 50s he did covers of R&B songs, and he did cover Tutti Frutti, for example, and his he's not in the Hard Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because people consider him to be a cultural appropriator. And my argument was, he's not a cultural appropriator because he's too lame. Like, you can only culturally appropriate something if in doing it, in covering it, you block the real thing from... So Elvis is a cultural appropriator. Once Elvis does Hound Dog, you know, Mama Thornton can't... Her version of Hound Dog doesn't... Is she the one? I can't remember.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe? That one? Or the different one?
Whatever, the original version.
Yes.
But Pat Boone's Tutti Frutti is not... Good. It's not a copy. It's Tutti Frutti, Tutti Frutti.
Yeah. So he really enunciates, doesn't he?
He does enunciate.
Yeah.
So the argument was, he's so lame, he can't be appropriator. He's so lame, he drives you to the real thing.
Yeah.
Right? So who gets in touch with me right after that episode airs? Pat Boone. Who is thrilled to bits.
Oh.
By that. So, like, you just never know. You never know what to do these things.
No, you don't know, but...
I'm sort of distressed.
Did he talk to Dave Hill, too?
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Dave has his finger on the pulse. Dave and I did a series of videos on YouTube, which have, like, 100 likes. Because Dave's best friends with Dick Cavett. So once you know that...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So Dave and I have done a series of... You can find a videos with me, Dave, and Dick Cavett. And there was one where my publisher got into a feud with Amazon. Because Amazon wanted to cut a new deal. And so for a period of about 5 months, they weren't shipping any of my publisher's books, mine included. So we did this video where I pretended that because Amazon was going from a situation where they were delivering books to a situation where they were not delivering books, then they would have to replace their head of fulfillment with someone who was incompetent. So the whole video was so meta. The whole video was Dick Cavett interviewing me and Dave Hill, and Dave Hill was the new Amazon head of fulfillment because they needed to have someone who was really bad at the job in order to, because they were making this big transition from delivering things to not delivering things. And it was so, I honestly think it was the best thing I've ever done. And it was so fantastic. And Dick Cavett is playing Dick Cavett. And Dave is like pretending he's like this incompetent who gets, he's like, you know, Amazon wanted us to stop delivering things, so who are they going to give a ring a ding to me? Anyway, no one watched this. But then 6 years pass, and I'm on my book tour, and I'm in Seattle. And one of the things you do when you're in Seattle is you go to Amazon.
Sure.
And you give the big talk. So I'm like, oh my God, this is such a genius opportunity. So I said to the Amazon person, do you mind if I play a video? And she's, the woman who was running it, it's like one of those, very nice, but she's a PR person for a major corporation, a little bit skittish. And she was like, well, can I see the video you want to play? I was like, no, you can't.
It's going to be so much better if I surprise you. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. But anyway.
Where
were we?
Anyway, Dave Hill, ladies and gentlemen, Dave Hill. He'll be so thrilled.
Dave would be happy.
But I am thrilled to talk about your book.
Okay.
I did read it, if that makes you feel better. I'm sure you've been on these tours where you can tell someone has not read your book. Does that happen?
Yeah. It does sometimes.
Yeah.
Very happy you took the time.
Yeah. So Strangers Talking to People. It's a very good title.
I'm not
going off there?
I was going to do a digression. Because I once did this. And I didn't read the book. And I thought that a guy asked me as a favor to do a Q&A in front of a large audience because he had a book coming out. And I thought I knew what the book was about. So I was like, I don't need to read it. It'll be fine. We'll just wing it. But then halfway through, I'm like, I disagree with everything this guy's. So I turned on him halfway through. It was very embarrassing. I couldn't, in good conscience. I was like, that's what your book's about? Are you kidding me? It did not go well.
We did discover, though, that we do like tangents in our conference, so be prepared. Nobody knows where this is going. I might at some point do one of those really like stereotypical, just throw the papers up and go, I don't know what's going on now, folks. But we will talk about the book. We are?
I was just unzipping my...
Oh, okay. Just getting more comfortable? So, what we should know about the people we don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like I jumped in really quickly to feeling I know you. But I realized it's because I've listened to your podcast, I read your books, I watch all your interviews. You're Canadian, so I feel that already right there.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing if you can just like, you know, stalk someone on the internet? Do you know them?
No.
I'm not saying I stalked you. That'd be weird, right?
No, I mean,
you know, I don't know where you live specifically in New York.
You know, I don't want to use the word persona. You know how I behave in public settings.
Yeah.
But that's not really.
No.
I mean, you have a public persona. Do you think, how authentic is your public persona?
Oh, I this is it. This is...
But if I only, let me ask the question to you. If all I did was listen to you and watch you in your... Do you think I would know you?
I think you'd have a pretty good sense of...
You don't change radically when you're...
I'm not very good at it. I mean, I think I would love to have like an alter ego or some other kind of personality, but I might forget to slip into it.
But you're an extrovert.
I'm a what?
You're an extrovert, surely.
Yes.
I'm not an extrovert.
No?
No.
I like to say that I'm both, but it's a lie, because it sounds... Because extroverts are not cool. No one says that, I love that cool extrovert. No, introverts are cool because they're that mysterious person in the corner at the party.
Really?
And they're like, oh, look at them, what are they thinking? And the extrovert's like juggling in the middle of the room. You know, anyone need more dip? That's me, right? Where you're over there, and I assume that I romanticize introverts.
Really?
That you are planning your next book, you're watching things. You hate everyone. Sort of. I always imagine, you know, introverts are sort of French or some sort. You know?
Can I tell you my favorite introvert story is I was once interviewing, I'm about to name drop, if that's okay.
Yeah, no.
I was once interviewing Magnus Carlsen, world's greatest chess player. And Magnus, as a chess player, is deeply introverted. And so we got along, we started talking about this notion that he lives inside of his head. And so I said, well, you know, when you practice chess, how much do you use a board and practice, or how much do you just do it inside your head? And he goes, well, mostly inside my head. He said, for example, I'm working on an opening right now.
Wow.
How awesome is that?
Yeah.
He also, my other Magnus Carlsen story is, so he's a chess player. And all he deals with is patterns, right? It's just all about patterns. So we're at lunch after I interviewed him, and we're with some friends. And my friend Michael was there, and Michael has a daughter named Maisie. And Maisie has had a friend with her whose name was Michelle. And my name is Malcolm. So we go around Maisie, Michael, Michelle, Malcolm, and we come to Magnus. And for the first time, his face lights up and he says, we are all M's. It's just a magnificent moment.
I honestly thought there was going to be a joke about what happens when two introverts get together. Like, what?
It was very beautiful. But I had never heard of this notion that I didn't know that extroverts kind of lionize introverts. I always thought that we were considered pathetic.
No. As long as you're not talking, we think you're cool, right? I'm an open book, right? You know exactly what I'm thinking all the time. I mean, if I have a thought, it's coming out. I mean, it's being shared. But the silent person over there, I assume...
Still waters.
There's going to be something really, like they are plotting, yeah. Or I don't know, something.
I don't feel like I have... I don't feel like I have still waters, but they don't run deep. I don't...
You're a shallow introvert.
I think I'm a shallow...
Wow. Did you get someone else to write this book, or no? So...
Did you?
You wrote this. I mean, most of it anyway, right?
I did. Yeah.
I mean, you're probably big enough that you could, you know, hire other out.
I don't understand why people would do that. It's the most fun. People, whenever I hear about people who outsource that part, or the research, or any part of it, I always say, why would you do that? Because that's what's fun, right? Like
the research.
Well, yeah. And the writing.
Yeah.
Well, both those are like, that's the, it's all the, I would happily outsource the book tour. I mean,
this obviously, this evening excluded
no,
from
no,
that.
This evening excluded. Yes. But there are plenty of people who could do a better job at the book tour than me. Right.
I don't know. Like... I think everyone here came to see you, and they're all very excited.
No, my point is like, well.
Point is, you wrote this book.
I wrote this book.
And you also have a lot of really interesting ideas.
Thank you.
That we all, I guess, enjoy. Is do we enjoy an idea? Is that the proper language? I enjoy your ideas.
Thank you.
That's it. So.
My mother didn't like this book.
You have another book?
No. I said my mother didn't like this book.
Oh.
My mother is like.
Oh.
She's a pretty tough critic. She's like most of my books, but she. You know when mothers are. My mother won't lie.
Mm-hmm.
She's 89, there's just no point. And she's incredibly supportive. But so she read the book and then she said, it's very dense. It's quite unlike your other work. And I said, yes, it's quite unlike it. She goes, and then I gave her this sort of spiel about how this book is really an audio book, masquerading as a written book, and the audio book is what you should consume if you can. Not that you shouldn't buy it.
A companion piece.
Companion.
So, yeah.
And she goes, oh yes, I see. That's very interesting the way you are in touch with your audience. And she completely checked out of the equation. Like, your audience out there, not your mom.
Yeah.
Who, that was sobering, but...
That's good. My mom's good for that too. She'll come and see me and she'll say something like, did you mean to wear that? And then I say, yeah. She's like, oh, good. No, I just wanted to make sure that that's what you intended to do. Like, I don't know. But if it is, good for you. Good for your bravery.
She's like, as an objective observer, someone with no skin in this particular game, I'm curious to know why you wrote.
You're never going to see a review on this book saying Malcolm's mom or something here.
No. I think my mother liked it. I think my mother who was very, my mother's very astute emotionally and picked up correctly on the fact that there is a lot of, this book is, there's heaviness, this emotional heaviness in it. And it, that is unlike my previous books, which are a lot sunnier. And I think that took her by surprise. I'm exaggerating when I say I think she liked it, but I think she was observing that it's not typical.
Was she concerned about you? Because when you say that, you know, there's a heaviness, did she think, oh, yeah, what are you going through? Like, what's...
Maybe.
I didn't mean for this to be analysis now. How did that make you feel?
No. When you're... I mean, what mother wouldn't be, wouldn't pick up on the fact that there's a lot of, I think maybe, actually, that had not occurred to me till now, and I think that maybe there's something to that. She's probably alert to, what does it say about my son, who has previously written books that are about success and, you know, curiosity and, you know, why things become popular, and now has written a book that has, like, chapters about torture.
Yeah. But you had, to start this book, you had it almost like in fiction, like an inciting incident of something that you learned about, and then you wanted to explore more, and it's sort of, in the way we were talking about tangents, it went off in different directions.
Yeah.
So can we talk about that with Sandra Bland?
Yeah. So she's the, you know, any of you will remember, she's in that string of high-profile cases where law enforcement confronts African Americans in America and things go awry. She's like case number 5. She's the young woman in Texas who's pulled over for failing to use a turn signal. And then she gets into an argument with the police officer and he drags her out of the car, arrests her. She gets thrown in prison. She commits suicide. And the whole thing's captured on the officer's desk cam video. And it is all of those cases both disturbed and fascinated me in the way that it did many Americans. But that one, for some reason, I simply could not get that case out of my head. And that's what that really is. So the book begins with that case and ends with that case. And it is an attempt to understand why is it that a conversation between two, in the middle of the day in a bucolic little Texas town, a woman gets pulled over for failing to use a turn signal, and how is it that things could go bad, so badly awry that she would end up dead 3 days later? So it struck me that there was something in that story that was powerfully evocative or characteristic of the time we're in. And so that's what got me going on this.
And you were saying that you spend a lot of time watching the video, reading the transcripts, and was there like, were you ever like hoping maybe if I do this enough times it'll change the ending? Because it doesn't make sense. And I think you said that too. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense that this happened.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you begin to sort of, the more you watch it, the more you see how many different things go wrong. And finally, as you know, if you've read the book, you'll know at the end of the book, I kind of throw up my hands and say, the only way to have prevented this is that police officers should not be stopping. He shouldn't have stopped her at all. In other words, it was an excessive, there are all kinds of things that I came to see as problematic in the way the case was processed in the media and in the public life. And that is a really important thing here. I think that the way in which a lot of these problematic stranger encounters are dealt with is profoundly wrong and flawed. For example, there was a whole strain that said, this is a case about racism, which it is profoundly. But I became convinced that way of making sense of it is a way of dismissing rather than resolving and addressing the issue. So the thing about these encounters between African Americans and law enforcement is, you know, we had in America a kind of 3-year window where we were obsessed with them, and then we sort of stopped. They still go on. Nothing has changed. There's still just as many of them. They just don't make the news anymore. They happen all the time. So we went through this kind of public, kind of very, 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 very sort of public obsession with them. And then we kind of shrugged. And the racism thing is what allowed us to move on. Because you're like, if your final position is, oh, this is really about the fact that that's a bad cop who is a racist. And then you're like, well, what are you going to do? Cops are racist. How are we going to solve the problem? You can't, like, you can't cleanse the hearts of every white cop in America. And so you say, you just accept that as a kind of cost of doing business in 21st century America. That strikes me as so, there's something, it was that conclusion that really, really began to sort of enrage me and led to the book. Because I find that attitude that, what are you going to do? To be, you know, lame is too lame a word for it, but it's just unacceptable.
Yeah, and where I went off to, I was thinking that as growing up out this area, one of the areas that if you want to go down to the United States, you're always having to stop at the border. It's almost like it's, and I've never done anything wrong, but when I get to the border, I'm like, I'm going to blurt something. Something's going to happen.
Oh, you, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, me.
Open book.
That particular, yeah, if I've done anything, they'll know, right? But I haven't, but I want to say something, and I don't know. Like, what are you going to do? I don't know. And then, you know, someone in the car is like, yeah, you're going to visit your friend in Bellingham. Like, I am. I'm going to, and then you're in trouble, right?
But
there is something about, yeah, which you explore, this authority figure relationship, which is different than just regular strangers, too.
Yeah, and particularly there, so I was just home in Waterloo, Ontario, and I noted that the local police in Waterloo have as their motto, people helping people, right? Now, if you're Canadian, it doesn't strike you as odd.
No.
I think here it's something about beyond the call, right? That's Vancouver. Again, this doesn't strike you as weird. In New York, it's to serve and protect.
Yeah.
In America, it's like the cop is like, you know, someone's coming for you. I will gun them down before they, you know, come even close to your three-car garage. I'm serving and I'm protecting. And in Waterloo, Ontario, it's like people helping people. Like, it's so beautiful, but also it's like a parody. It's like a Canadian parody.
I'm just like you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's embedded in those two mottos is a powerful cultural difference about what the function of authority is in society, right? I mean, I remember, this is a tangent, but these are all tangents. I remember my parents, quite late in life, moved from the Presbyterian Church to the Mennonite Church. And I remember my father coming home once from a congregation meeting, and my parents were blissfully happy with this change. And they were having a meeting to pick a new pastor. And he said the existing pastor who was leading sat in the audience, in the congregation, with the congregation, as opposed to leading the meeting. And he found that touched him in this kind of really powerful, I remember he was moved by it, that you would have as a notion of leadership, that you would sit with the people you were leading with them, and not, it wasn't a hierarchy, but you, I defy you to find a church in the United States where the pastor would sit with the congregation when they were picking a new leader. Just not in the way they think. And there's a real, and so this officer, the story of Sandra Bland isn't in some sense, it's part of that mindset that the officer is determined to protect his authority and has a kind of paranoid fantasy about threats to his authority. You know, there's a moment where she's someone who is, we learn later, is someone who has had a very troubled recent history, a recent suicide attempt, lost a baby, trying to start her life over in Texas. And she gets into it with this cop, and she lights a cigarette, which is her way of, she's trying to calm herself down, calm her nerves. And she thinks she's signaling to the cop that I want to de-escalate things. And he sees her lighting a cigarette as a threat to his authority. And that's really the crucial moment when the encounter goes off the rails. But that's the whole thing. Like, he's locked into one interpretation of events, which is, it's about my authority. If you're going to light a cigarette, you're fucking with me. She's not. She's like, she's trying to calm down, right? And it's that sort of, and I feel like if your motto is people helping people, it's a little easier to understand something from someone else's perspective.
Well, there's something about him too that seemed like he thought a lot was riding on this. Like, this is a very important event for both of us. This is meaningful.
Yeah.
And it really, before what happened, isn't. This is, why did you think he thinks this is so important?
Yeah. Well, because he is a participant in a philosophy of law enforcement, which the United States has adopted in the last generation, many, many jurisdictions in the United States, which empowers police officers, turns them into engines of suspicion and paranoia. So they are trained to think the worst of everyone they encounter. And that's a big theme in the book because...
Yeah, you talk about the different police forces that are trained that way.
But also, the book is very strongly an argument for the opposite, that we need to trust each other implicitly, even if that means that we will occasionally be deceived. That's a small... Being deceived is the price we pay for being human. We need to stop stressing out of the fact that we get taken every now and again by con men and swindlers, and accept that as...
That said, you also have some encounters where some other meetings of strangers go very badly and the world goes to war.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I used it. Yeah. Yeah. the world goes to war. And that is a chapter in here. Oh, look, I just put Hitler up here on my bookmark. So getting to know Der Führer.
Yeah.
Here. So I have to think that in the history of the world, there couldn't have been a worse reading of another human being than the Prime Minister of England meeting Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
Would you think that's... It's one of the worst.
Well, you know, recent events.
Ah, okay.
But... Yeah, no, it's pretty bad. I will point out, that... So the weird fact about foreign Western leaders and Hitler is how few of them actually met him. So Franklin Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill never met Hitler, which is weirdly unthinkable. Mm-hmm. We would imagine the only people who met Hitler were the French Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, who goes to visit him twice, and of course William Lyon Mackenzie King.
Yeah, who you say just loved him.
Loved him.
In fact, you put loved in italics here. He loved him.
He loved him.
Yeah.
He went, and he just was blown. He went, I think he went in 36 or 37, 1936, to visit Hitler, and was blown away, which goes to my point about how unexpectedly dangerous it is to meet people face-to-face. I feel we should limit our face-to-face encounters as much as possible.
As an introvert would say, but okay.
But no, that chapter is exploring this paradox that the people who got Hitler right...
Yeah.
With the people who never met him, and the people who got him wrong with the people who did meet him. So once you accept that fact, mm-hmm. you sort of have to wonder about things like job interviews and such. Churchill stayed home and read Mein Kampf. Neville Chamberlain got on a plane and flew to Munich and thought that Hitler was like, had no intention of invading anyone in Europe. Like, what's better? I think that I wasn't making a joke about job interviews. I've become a radical on this. Once you understand, and the book I sort of walk through various arguments for how perilous the face-to-face encounter is, and how much of the information you gather in that moment is potentially misleading or worse, then you have to say, well, maybe part of what it means to be an effective human being is to really think hard about what are my reasons? So in a professional setting, obviously, if you're going to date someone,
yeah.
I think you want to, right? Probably useful, right?
Yes.
but absent, let's bracket romantic encounters for a moment. In other contexts, are you sure? Like, why are you so... Imagine if you were replaying political situations, and I said, from now on, we're going to conduct all political campaigns in such a way that you never, ever lay eyes on the candidate. So we're going to put the candidate behind essentially a screen, and you will get access to what the candidate thinks and says, but you have no clue whatsoever about who they are. Would we be better or worse off?
Well, isn't that the famous Kennedy-Nixon debate? That those who heard it on the radio thought Nixon won, those who watched on TV thought Kennedy won. Yeah. And we all know what those two guys look like, right?
Yeah.
And but apparently Nixon got really sweaty, but when they couldn't see, they were listening.
So this is, in the context of American politics, I once did this experiment where I took, for the last 100 years, I made a list of all of the people who have run for president, the Democrat and Republican candidates. And then I made a note, it's like a chart, and I made a note of their gender, their race, their religion, their age, and their height. Okay? Five variables. What you do if you just do that exercise is you discover that with like two exceptions or three exceptions, they are all white Protestant males who are between the ages of 55 and 65 and over 6 foot tall.
Okay? Yeah.
Then I said, okay, what percentage of the American population is white, male, Protestant, between 55 and 65 and over 6 feet tall? And the answer is less than 10%. Probably that's a high estimate. So because we are clearly, for some reason, which probably has to do with the fact that we observe these people, for the most important job in the free world, we are confining our search to 10% of the population. That would be like me starting a company and, a tech company in Vancouver and saying that I'm only recruiting people from, what was the town you're from?
White Rock.
That's the equivalent.
See, that's a White Rock's a joke here.
I know. Yeah. But that's my point.
Yeah.
I'm starting a tech company. I want to blow away Google and Apple and whatever, and I'm going to search for the smartest people in North America in White Rock.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
I'll be coming to you. I'd be like, Lisa, you're the best I got. I need you to do some high-end coding because we're up against the best from Google.
Do we get free granola bars and free salt? Because that's all I'm looking for.
Yeah. We laugh about this, but this is exactly what we're doing with America, with politics. We are picking from the same narrow, everyone with vanishingly few exceptions, everyone's in that, what I just described. Why do we keep doing this? Why? It's because we meet these people and we just fall for the same type over and over again. Well, why don't we try and fix it and stop meeting them?
Yeah.
So now think about this in terms of job interviews. Are you sure you need to meet the person that you're interviewing for the job? Why do you need to meet them? What exactly are you gathering of relevance to the job by this?
It's almost like there's something people think that's mystical, that they'll pick something up. And you did mention Neville Chamberlain in the book, the quote was that he looked into Hitler's eyes and said, I could tell this was a good man.
But he's using, think about that, he's using the language of romance.
Yes,
isn't
yes,
he?
Yes.
Right? He can't help it. That's what happens when we do face-to-face. Yeah. We fall into that model. That there is some kind of, you're looking for chemistry, he's looking for non-sexual chemistry. Why are we so obsessed with, do you really have to have chemistry with your political leader?
But that's an old trope, that one, right? I'd like to have a beer with that guy. I'm like, I don't want my leader to have a beer with me.
Yeah.
I want them better than me. I don't want them hanging out with me.
Yeah.
I want them smarter, with way better company.
I want them
playing chess with Magnus there, and winning.
Better things to do.
Yeah,
it's a crazy, it is a crazy model. And I think it's because so many of our associations about face-to-face encounters are really formed as adolescents in the context of sexual attraction. And we can't walk away from that. Like on this book tour that I'm on, I was chatting at one point with this very, very prominent social psychologist. We were talking about, with small children, we're talking about how he picks babysitters. I was like, well, why do you need to meet the babysitter? He's like, well, I have to meet the babysitter. So why do you need to meet? Do you really think you can tell from a 20-minute encounter with the babysitter whether the babysitter is going to raid your liquor cabinet? He was like, yeah. You can't, right? He was like, well, I like to see the way they drive up the driveway, which I thought was the most, this is a guy who's like one of the, he's a brilliant psychologist, and he was reduced to like, this is gibberish. This is gibberish. You can't tell from the way they drive up your driveway whether they're going to be kind and devoted to your children.
So
you can't.
So how can we? Now we're all afraid. All these people are phoning their babysitter right now.
Well, that's my point. I mean, there are things you can do, maybe, you know. But I think you need to surrender the falsehood, and it is a falsehood, that you could somehow see into the heart of a babysitter in 20 minutes and divine whether they are. The truth is, most people...
It's literally a horror movie you're describing right now.
But here's the truth. That people who want to be babysitters are, generally speaking, people who are pretty good at being a babysitter. That is to say, it's not a job that I would volunteer to do because I don't want to spend a lot of time with small children. But people
yes.
who volunteer for a job with small children generally like small children. I think you could probably just proceed on that assumption.
Well, I think we just like to meet people. I think that, I mean, now we're all going to be nervous about meeting people, but that's okay. That was how helpful from you. Thank you.
No, that's... It's just useful. When you consider the number of times that our interactions with people are deeply flawed, or that we draw conclusions that are unwarranted, I think it's just useful to think about that and to back away a little bit from the excessive overconfidence we have about our ability to read others.
And spies, because I happen to have, for a long time, thought plan B of my life would be go into spying. I don't know why. I thought it'd be fun. I watched
you?
A lot. I know I would not be good. I've learned this now. But, you know, you read a lot of John le Carré novels, and you get into thinking.
Who were you imagining you might spy for? Like, which?
Which country?
Because I don't think you're, I mean, with
no.
all due respect.
I more wanted to get, like, a really cool apartment in Prague, like, in the Bourne Identity. It's more to do about the travel, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, like a safety deposit box in each city that you just go in, you know, and
okay.
kind of hang out with Matt Damon or whatever.
I could see that.
I haven't really thought it through.
No.
I'm not,
no, I don't think you have.
But now,
yeah.
I just... After reading, and this is a heads up for everyone, it's like the most useless thing in the world, spies, right?
Well, I tell, you know, I deeply love spy stories, and I tell a number of, as you know,
yeah.
spy stories in the book, all of which have the same theme, which is spies. All of our narratives about spies come from spy movies and spy novels, and there are three components to the spy narrative. Number one is that the spy, those who are taken in by a spy or a deceiver of any kind, are in some way vulnerable to deception. Negligent, stupid, impaired. Number two is that there's a limit to the number of times people can be fooled by a spy. Once you get deceived once, you wise up. And part three is that in order to be successful, the spy, him or herself, has to be possessed of some kind of evil genius. All three of these assumptions, totally false. The people who get taken in by spies tend to be incredibly sophisticated, really good at their jobs. Spies don't just fool us once, they fool us over and over and over and over again.
Especially if they're Tom Cruise and they can rip your face off. And
when
just
they
start
when
over
you're removing,
them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And most importantly, the spies are never, they're not Bond villains. Spies tend to be quite inept. The one, I tell the story of Anna Montes in the book, this famous spy, one of the most damaging spies of the 20th century in the U.S. intelligence establishment. She is working for Castro from the minute she sets foot in the intelligence community in the U.S. She's a terrible spy.
Yeah.
When they capture her, 10 years later, they finally capture her. She has the codes that she uses to communicate with Havana in her purse. Like, this is like, it would be as if I kept all of the passwords to all of my accounts in my wallet.
right?
That's if that hiding in plain sight, right? That's,
I'm just checking. No, I don't have them there.
Oh.
I don't have all, why don't I do that? Because I have a modicum of intelligence.
And you're not a spy.
She does not. And then when they break into her apartment, where do they find the radio that she uses to communicate with Havana? In a shoebox in her closet. Like, do you understand? This is weird.
You and I are counterintelligence agencies. We're going to go and search Anna Montes' apartment for signs of treasonous behavior. And we ask the question, where do you suppose she keeps the radio? And I say, jokingly, in a Cole Haan box in her closet. And sure enough, that's where it is.
Well, she obviously didn't get paid very well as a spy if it's in a Cole Haan box. I would have liked, you know, maybe a little bit more, right? You know?
You'd have had in the notes.
No, like, my point, like, so this whole, the whole Bond narrative that someone is, like, cackling and, like, pulling the wool. No. They're not cackling and pulling the wool over our eyes. They're like, this is like, these are people who are too dumb. I mean,
here's the other thing about spies. I don't go into this in the book, but I've always wondered this about spies. This is why I've always had a low opinion of spies. Invariably, when you hear the spy story, you hear like, so-and-so, over the course of 10 years, you know, gave the Soviets the crown jewels of the American intelligence community, like keys to this and this and this and this and this. Like, okay, so this person was super damaging. And then you ask the question, well, okay, what do they get for doing this? And the answer is always, you find out how much money they were paid. And it's always like, you know, $20,000. So they give away billions of dollars in secrets, but they are so dumb that when it comes time to like settle accounts with their handler, they're like, you know, what do you want for giving us the keys to the kingdom? And they're like, well, what do you think, 15, 20 grand?
And maybe your Honda Civic, it looks like it's still going.
And when you, like, Aldrich Ames, who was the most damaging spy of the 20th century, he literally gives away everything. And what does he do with his money? Well, he, like, buys a Jaguar. Like, he's literally deceived. He's like, I mean, billions of dollars of damage. And he's like, I think I want to drive something a little nicer. I'm going to trade in the Hyundai. Can I get something maybe in a V8, you know, maybe with power windows? If you could work that for me, that'd be great. And the Soviets are like, how much of an idiot is this man? And he would buy like fancy Italian suits. He should have had $100 million in the bank. That's how dumb these. So this is the great puzzle of deception. These guys are blithering idiots. They don't even know the value of the information they're handing over, right? Klaus Fuchs, the guy who gave the nuclear bomb to the Soviets in the 1940s. Again, top five damaging spy of the 20th century. He didn't ask for any money at all. It was a freebie. He was like, here's a nuclear bomb. This one's on me. Let's talk later. He's risking his life for this, right? Risking his life. It's like, yeah.
I thought they had special training and like they could jump through tires and go in mud and
it's astonishing.
Speak nine languages.
It's astonishing how bad these guys are. And that's the puzzle. That's actually the puzzle that I did. Even before Sandra Bland, I read spy novels constantly. And I also like true life spy stories. And I've always been puzzled by this fact about why are they so lame? Like, they're just super lame. And they get away with it forever. Like, it's the same thing with, I have a chapter on Bernie Madoff. It's the same thing. Bernie's not an evil genius. Bernie, the architect of the worst Ponzi scheme, financial fraud in human history, is like, here's how lame he is. He has his accountant on his like financial disclosures. He lists his accountant for what is supposed to be a $40 billion hedge fund. The accountant is like an 85-year-old guy named like Joe, who has a one-man operation in a strip mall in Rockland County. Now, for those of you who don't know the New York area, it's just New York, it's possible to go in many directions from
New York City and find very sophisticated, educated people. Rockland County is not one of those places.
No leading universities, no, yeah.
You know, Rockland County is like, I don't know what the equivalent here is in Vancouver, but if you're putting Rockland County on like the display page of your $40 billion hedge fund, you're not the smartest schemer in the world. Like, you're basically telling people, I'm making all this up because my account is from Rockland County, right?
But like, at a certain point with people, though,
yeah.
Aren't we wanting to believe things we want? Like, we, even if, like you said, the evidence to suggest otherwise, that this where his accountant is, when you start realizing you've given a lot of money and you see that, aren't we like all of a sudden then going, I gotta convince myself? Is that what we're doing too?
Well, we're doing, I mean, this is part of this larger point that I make in the book, which is, this is this idea of Tim Levine's, this researcher who's, you know, one of the great puzzles in psychology is, why are we so bad at detecting lies? And Levine's answer, which is a novel answer, is that we're bad at detecting lies because, paradoxically, evolution did not select us for that particular trait. As interesting and important as it may seem, evolution selected us to be trust machines, to believe what people say. Because if you implicitly believe what people say, then your life is so much easier and you can be so much more productive and you can, and you're just a nicer person. I mean, if the game here is to pass on your genes, who's a better shot at passing on their genes? The squirrely, defensive, paranoid person or the person who's like lovely and trusting? Right?
Yeah.
Really, really hard for the paranoid person to replicate, to propagate. Right? You're not, just think about it. So that's his point. So like, so whose genes win? Trusting genes win. So why does Bernie Madoff get away with Rockland County? Because everyone's like, well,
that's his thing.
Maybe there's just a special part of Rockland County. Maybe this brilliant 85-year-old solo accountant got priced out of the more sophisticated parts of the metro area. You know, that's what we do.
I feel like giving my money right now. I thought all made sense to me what you just said, so.
But, and that's not a bad thing, by the way. That's, as you know, the big argument's book.
Yeah.
I like that fact about us. It's fine. Trust people. Don't get hung up on.
Well, it's World War II right there. We just brought that up. That was a problem.
Well, you know, he had other options. If he understood the extent to which, if he, as I think that we ought to, if he took into account the dangers of the willingness with which we will be taken in by the easily to be taken in by con men, you should have stayed home. Just stay home and read Mein Kampf. By the way, so Hitler writes a book three times thicker than that, in which he just lays it all out, right? All you have to do is read the book. Just finish the book. Like, you don't have to go and see him in Munich. He's already told you what he thinks. He's published it. You can buy it at a bookstore. That's what everyone else is doing. They're all like reading the book, like, oh, he's like a bad guy. And Chamberlain's like, no. I would rather go and chat with him, have tea with him, than read the manifesto the man wrote.
Well, if it was three times the size of, that's a long bit of reading to do, so, you know.
But this is this weird thing that we privilege in a way that we, and one of the many mistakes we make with people is that we privilege the information that we gather personally over sort of objective indications of somebody's belief or character, right? We always think, oh, you know, you're interviewing a person who's been fired from their last three jobs, and you say, but I really like that person. Well, actually, no. Probably better to take into account the fact that they're fired from the last three jobs. That seems to be a useful bit of information. Are you a basketball fan?
No.
No. Do you know who Kawhi Leonard is?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
Kawhi.
I mean.
So Kawhi is a great.
I'm a basketball fan, but I am a Canadian. So.
You are a Canadian. There's a great Kawhi story along these very lines. Kawhi is coming out of college, and he's being The Phoenix Suns are thinking of drafting him. So the general manager of the Phoenix Suns has a meeting with Kawhi. Kawhi shows up, he's wearing a suit, he's 19 years old, and he's sweating. You can see through the suit, he's got circles under his armpits. And the general manager of Phoenix Suns says, I'm not gonna draft him. I want someone who's cool under pressure. Now, of course, Kawhi is the coolest dude under pressure in history. And so the question is, why on earth would the general manager privilege the information gathered from a encounter with Kawhi Leonard for half an hour in a conference room over the hours of tape he has of Kawhi Leonard actually playing basketball, right? It's the same, it's the Neville Chamberlain problem. What are you doing? You already know how well this guy plays basketball. What's the point of meeting with him? Are you hiring him to like sell cars? Or, I mean, does he have to be, do you care what he looks like? How do you know he's not just hot in the suit?
Or hasn't got a good deal or anything.
He's a 19-year-old kid. Yeah. This guy whiffs on, he doesn't draft him, and he whiffs on the greatest talent of, one of the great talents of his generation. Precisely because he makes this error, which he gets hung up on the information he gathers personally from this sort of encounter. And I feel like we just have to back away from that.
The one area that I, when I read the book, I thought you would do a little more on dating. And we have some examples, but that's the place where it's the most bizarre about meeting strangers, right? I mean, that's bad. It's hard, right? I mean, and especially if you have done, as you're saying, like, awesome, this person looks great on paper. Let's just get married now. You've got all of this, check. But you wouldn't, I mean, I know that's an actual reality show, isn't it? Engaged for 1 week or something, but it's weird, right? Did you think about that? Or was it, I mean, I don't think the Stanford sexual assault and Amanda Knox are like dating.
No. Didn't think of dating. The problem with doing a dating chapter is that when you go in your book tour, then people will just ask you about the dating chapter.
And okay. No, but I did. I talked about a non-dating chapter.
You did. Anyway, so there goes that theory. Turns out they'll bring it up anyway. Dating very interesting. I'm always amused by the algorithms that online dating services use, which, as far as I can tell, they try to put you with someone who shares as many of your interests as you do. Which I always thought is a kind of really kind of quaint and erroneous notion about who we're attracted to. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I'm not someone who's filled with self-hatred, but the last thing I would want to do is date someone who had shared my interests. That just sounds to be really unhealthy. You know, over-exercises, spends most days by himself in a coffee shop, avoiding human contact, you know, is emotionally withholding. I go on, like, the last thing I want, I mean, I want to go as far as possible from Malcolm Gladwell to give our offspring some hope of normalcy. I mean,
is that not a setting? You can, like, complete opposite.
I think you should be able to do that. But no, but the notion that they would be, that they would try and rationalize, which is something that is clearly completely irrational, is hilarious. Like, you should just throw your name in a hat, surely. That seems to be much more reasonable.
But then people always critique the meet cute in a rom-com because they think it's fake. Because they meet and it doesn't make sense that these two folks would meet each other. What's she doing on this plane that was canceled and he was on there and he's a farmer and she's a banker or whatever, right? And then, because everyone's like, well, that'll never work.
Do you know how people always tell those meet cute stories? And they're invariably about like random encounters with people, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm someone who's travels a lot. Say I fly a lot. So I always think about this for years. I've been flying for 25 years. Never once in 25 years have I ever sat next to someone who could even conceivably fall into a meet cute category.
No.
So I just think, not that I want to, I'm in a relationship. I'm just saying, hypothetically, has this ever happened to me? The answer is never. So I really wonder, like, what, first of all, is this something,
am I just simply unlucky? Or is this just made up? Like, I always just sit, I'm always sitting next to the...
What? I wasn't winking at you, that was weird.
Something happened.
No, there was... There was
somebody was...
There was...
No, I'm just... Yeah. It's just never... I mean, I always get the... I always get, like, the middle-aged guy going to his offside sales meeting.
Yes, but here's the thing you weren't thinking. Then you get off the plane, his sister comes to pick him up. You just didn't play the long game, that's all.
Where were we?
We were on the cute and how, it's hard.
Who did you? Do you?
Do I fall in love on airplanes a lot?
No.
Yes. Yes.
Do you find yourself in lots of potential meet cute situations?
As an extrovert, yeah, I do.
Oh, you would,
I do. I talk to everybody, and yeah, I can. Rom-coms look highly plausible to me all the time.
Can I tell you my this is a true story. I'm gonna name drop again.
Ooh.
But this is an absolute true story. 100%. And part of the problem, there's two problems here. One is that I need glasses and never wear them. And the second problem is I have a little bit of a version of that face thing, or I have difficulty recognizing people's faces.
Oh.
So I am in a restaurant in Miami, and I'm working away, a deadline of some kind, and a woman sits down next to me, and she starts to engage me in conversation. And I am very brusque. And she tries again. She goes, "What are you eating?" I go, So finally, she's quite persistent, then she gives up. And then she starts chatting with other people in the restaurant. And I'm working away. And then I think, first of all, she's really attractive. Like this is when I was years ago, I was single. She's really attractive, probably not a smart move on my part too. And then I wait for 10 minutes and I think, she's really familiar looking. Jennifer Aniston. I will live with that till the day I die.
Yes.
It's just so deeply humiliating.
Okay, but if
and
I
then
could...
I checked, and she was between boyfriends. It was like in her. There's like with someone like that. There's like a 1 week window.
She
got 1 week.
She
was in the window.
No. I have some news here that might change your mind.
What?
One of the things I was going to ask you about is being you, and how it's not just about your books or your podcasts. It's about how you're in pop culture. Pop culture, you're a part of it. And just in watching The Good Place, Tahani had a book, and there's a fake review from you. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Then I'm reading, this is just random, because I spent a lot of time reading about you. Sometimes I took a break, and you kept popping back up again. So I'm reading an interview with Jennifer Aniston in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Yes, I was.
She doesn't mention it, does she?
Just, no, but...
Oh.
So... She's got a new TV show, which I'm sure you know about, being a fan, that is coming out where she's playing a newscaster. And she's responsible for creating the character. So in the interview, she said, it says, on set, Aniston handpicked her character's books, 100 Years of Bauhaus on her coffee table, Malcolm Gladwell's Blink in her work bag.
This is hard. You're killing me right now.
She's never forgotten. And I happen to know her and Justin Theroux broke up like 2 years ago, so she's not even looking for rebound. She's looking for real, I was going to move on to questions now that I've just ruined your life here, but anyway, you can always slip the new book into her work bag, and I think that's...
So she's one of those, there's some Hollywood stars who are way, 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 way more attractive in person.
Oh. I could tell. Yeah. She seems nice, too. Doesn't she? Oh, see, look, she talked to you in a coffee shop. But seriously, she's a bit behind in your books, so, you know,
yeah, no,
right?
Yeah, she's 3 books behind.
So it is time to refresh the book bag for her new character. All right, can we asked for some questions, and I had a look through some of them. This one is from, Lisa, not me. What do you feel has been the biggest lesson you've learned so far in life, other than the Jennifer Aniston story, that has made the greatest impact on you?
Wow. That seems like a lot. biggest lesson. Could you answer that question?
The biggest lesson that I've ever...
has changed?
I could make something up for you on the spot.
In my experience, you know how people always say, don't go to bed angry? Wrong. Go to bed angry. Because 9 times out of 10, by the time when you wake up, you're not angry.
Yeah.
Right?
It's
like the worst advice in the world. Basically, so it's 2 a.m., you're having a fight with, you know, your significant other, you're exhausted, it's been going on forever, you're at wit's end, and the advice is, settle it then. Yo, that's really smart.
Yeah.
Settle it when you're in the wee hours of the morning when you're on your last, legs. No. Go to bed angry. Settle it in the morning when you're rested.
Yeah, a cup of coffee, things will look different.
And this is part of a larger point that most of the reasons why people get upset dissipate. This is so part and parcel of this whole notion that when you have an emotion, because I'm talking to an extrovert, but the notion that when you have an emotion, you're always better off expressing it immediately in some kind of authentic form is such nonsense.
Well, sorry, that's my philosophy, so.
Just hide it inside. What's that?
Put it into a little dog or let it come out at an inappropriate moment? That I also do
what's
that
it?
Sometimes.
By the way, that incredible song, which as a kid, it took me 30 years to figure it out. Remember, don't cry out loud, hold it inside, learn how to hide your feelings.
Yeah.
Don't cry out loud.
Yeah.
Why? How did someone get that song on the radio? It's that's the introvert's anthem. That's the repressed introvert's anthem. Hold it inside, learn how to hide your feelings.
The irony is that it's a big power ballad, too.
It's a power ballad. It's crazy.
Don't cry. I mean, it's big.
It's the craziest thing. The minute I realized, I listened to those lyrics, I was like, good Lord, whose idea was this? It's so fantastic.
It's probably a good karaoke song.
They probably had a verse about going to bed angry. Just that's on the extended play version.
Suck it in. Now this question.
Who sang that song?
Sorry, Melissa. I think it's what is her name? I can see her with the curly hair. It's not Melissa Etheridge, but it was a Melissa. Who? Melissa Manchester. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. One of my friendly extroverts down there. Thank you. We'll let you know.
Yeah.
We didn't get to this part of the book, so this is good that there's a question about this. So you might need to do some context, because it's someone who read the book already. Given your view of coupling, what does Mr. Gladwell think of proposals to ban guns? Sorry, this is a question from Helena. To ban guns, assault rifles, or handguns made by politicians during this federal election campaign. Is that an effective strategy for decreasing violent crime, or is there a scenario that would be more effective?
That such question strikes me as rhetorical. Is that a little bit? Sure, it is. I mean, so, as you know, a big section of the book on this notion of what's called coupling, this idea that one of the ways in which we misunderstand people is we fail to properly account for their environmental context, the ways in which their behavior is coupled to something. And I have a long discussion of suicide in that context. that you cannot understand why, whether someone is a suicide risk, unless you understand the method of suicide that they are choosing to engage in. That is clearly analogous to gun violence, violent behavior is coupled to the availability of guns. Why do police have the highest rate of suicide of any profession in society? It is not because being a police officer is uniquely stressful. There are many stressful professions. It's because police officers have access, the easiest access to guns, right? And similarly, whenever there is easy access to guns, you see, in any context, you see suicide rates go up. Why? Because it's a really simple, easy, and incredibly lethal way of killing yourself. In fact, I often think that we're in an age, a moment right now, where suicide rates are rising, and where in many cases suicide rates, deaths from suicide, greatly exceed deaths from homicide. It would be very useful for particularly in the United States, to have a discussion about guns which left homicide completely out of it and just talked about suicide, right? That's, to my mind, it is an equally, if not more, powerful argument, but it's far more politically palatable. Let's just move it, because when you talk about it in the context of homicide, you're like, oh, I want to defend myself against the intruder. Blah, blah. No, let's talk about vulnerable people who have access to guns are far more likely to take their lives than without guns. Because one thing that people forget is that many methods of suicide are not terribly lethal. So people who try to commit suicide by taking pills, adults, rarely succeed. People who try to commit suicide by shooting themselves almost invariably succeed or not. Well, much higher rate. So it really makes a difference if you have guns around. In America, I've forgotten the exact number, but I think it's close to 40,000 deaths from suicide a year. It's a huge number. Right? I would love to have a discussion about gun control that was just in that context.
Mm-hmm. This is a question from Marnie, and I really like this one. What is your favorite question to ask others?
Oh, such a good question. I have many, there are many different contexts, but, in an interview, a journalistic interview, or in a kind of personal encounter, I thought for the longest time, so when I was, because I got very, 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 I'm obsessed with job interviews, so let's talk about job interviews. So the question is, one of the things I make people who apply for jobs with me do is, to redact the names of the institutions they attend. So that's a question I would never ask, and I don't want to know. Right? So that's on one end of the ledger. So what do I want to know? Well, for the longest time, I would only hire people who could drive stick. So I'd always ask them. So, because my whole thing was, this is for when I was hiring assistants. So you get a 21-year-old, or 22-year-old in the 21st century, and if they can drive stick, that tells you a lot about them. It says that they have mastered something they don't need to master for a set of reasons that have something other to do with convenience. And that it also suggests, in many cases, a particular kind of relationship with their parents that's interesting. Right? Because typically you learn to drive stick because, in many cases, your dad says you need to learn to drive stick. Right. Yeah. And I really like the person who, A, has a father who says you need to learn to drive stick, and follows through on that and learns how to drive stick. So I would only hire people who drive, and I had the most incredible run of luck with these people who I hired to drive. So like one guy, Jacob, who's now was my assistant, now is a producer, now is my producer in Revisionist History. Fantastic young man. Great hire. I remember, it was the first question I asked him. He was like, "Do you drive stick?" He's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "Why do you drive stick?" He's like, "Well, because I had a job parking cars one summer and I need to drive stick." And I said, at that point, I didn't tell him, but I was like, "You're hired." That's so fantastic, right? Told me everything I need to know. He's not some fancy kid. He's got a work ethic. He mastered that task.
so we could get a job parking cars. Fantastic. Come.
Wow. Well, my niece got a car and insisted that it had stick. I can't wait to tell her.
Do you drive stick?
I do not, no. I did. I didn't know how to do that, and I borrowed a friend's car for a whole summer, and I just never put it in reverse. Which you gotta really, you should give me points for creativity, because honestly, finding places where you don't have to reverse a car, it's quite a challenge.
This is getting worse.
This is one we'll take you back to. I'm sure you've been asked this before, but could you clarify the 10,000 hours?
Oh my God.
See, I knew that you would say that. And do you feel it's changed? Well, you know, it's just, and the only reason I'm asking is because some people you say, oh, Malcolm Gladwell, and they go, isn't that 10,000 hour guy? You know, you've heard that before? Yeah, sorry, it happens. They go blink, or then they go, oh, that tipping point on the 10,000 hours, right? Yeah, I can see you're happy with that.
Well, there's several things. One is that you lose control over an idea when you put it in a book, and boy, did I lose control over that one. So there was a whole massive backlash against the 10,000-hour idea, which was distinguished by the fact that it was a backlash against something that I never said. My only point, first of all, it doesn't apply to anything except cognitively complex tasks. So people wanted to apply it to sports. I have no idea whether it applies to sports. It applies to chess and computer coding and writing really brilliant pop songs, but I'm not sure, and maybe being a surgeon. Didn't apply to, like, you know, playing football. I mean, you don't need 10,000 hours to be a running back. So that was one thing that, and then people got really, they thought I was saying that talent doesn't matter, which is the opposite of what I was saying. I was saying that you have to have talent. I mean, I can compose music for 10,000 hours. I'm not going to become the Beatles, ever. You need to be as brilliant as Paul McCartney to be Paul McCartney.
But you see yesterday yet? Totally different scenario. Anyway.
I know, I haven't. By the way, there was a, sorry, finish my thought.
Oh, yeah.
I almost wanted to go to
sorry, tangent. I took you in there. That's my fault.
But you need to have talent. The point is that in order to be expressed in its fullest extent, talent requires a lot of time and commitment. That was the point of that argument, right? And so when you think about what makes someone successful, the notion of the overnight success is false. It never happens. Successful people are people who combine some kind of innate ability with an extraordinary desire to make the most of it. That's the only point I was making, which is a totally uncontroversial point and has very little to do with the way that... What I was going to say when you brought up Paul McCartney is Conan O'Brien, and here I'm going to...
Name drop.
Yeah.
Is that your next book, Name Drop?
No. I did. Although, do you remember I did a podcast once on some funny guy who knew lots of famous people and was going to call his autobiography Name Drops Keep Falling on My Head. So genius. No, I did Conan O'Brien's podcast. Hasn't come out yet. And in which I discovered that he's like, in person, over an hour and a half, the funniest guy who, he just laughed. I didn't say anything. I just laughed for an hour and a half. And then, you know how my jaw was like completely sore. So then I was like, I got to listen to his podcast, because his podcast. So I listened to the one he did like a six-parter with Dana Carvey. And in part one, the first 10 minutes is maybe the funniest 10 minutes of audio I've heard in a very, very long time. Because Dana Carvey does the whole joke is that Paul McCartney, played by Dana Carvey, is somehow managing to have a conversation with John Lennon from heaven. He's catching John Lennon up on what's happened over the last 25 years. It is, I can't even do it justice. It's so bananas. It's so genius. And Dana Carvey's Paul McCartney is unreal. Like, you honestly think that you're listening to Paul McCartney talk. And Conan O'Brien does this kind of deadpan John Lennon.
And it's one joke, which is that John Lennon can't believe the way the world has changed. The obvious joke, but it's just the way in which they, and that's part of what the genius of the comedy is. They never deviate from that one joke. So all they're doing is circling around that one joke and just endlessly tweaking it. And so you think, oh no, they can't possibly do another riff on this. And they do. And then you think, oh no, they're done. And then they keep going and going and going. And at this point, I was listening to it on the treadmill and I nearly fell off the treadmill. I was laughing so hard. Anyway, the guy's a genius. And I hadn't understood that Dana Carvey, what an extraordinary, I mean, I'd forgotten it, but yes, an incredible impressionist he is. I recommend that to all of you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I was a little bit skeptical because I kind of resented that article they did at Conan when they're like, he finally saves podcasts. And I was like, what? Saves what? Like, did you see that? Yeah. That there was, that he was the savior of podcasting. No, I'm glad. I mean, I guess. I mean, it's good that Conan landed somewhere after the whole Jay Leno thing. I mean, I don't know. But on your recommendation.
You're a little more generous.
I don't feel Conan's missing anything without me. That's another thought. Do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll send him a note saying sorry.
You should.
No, come on. It was just that he got, and I'm happy to hear it's good because people were recommending it to me, but I was being really stubborn. I'm a Taurus extrovert, so that's what we do.
He really is. There is some kind of, and it's funny because you realize that he was actually ill-suited for a network talk show.
Huh.
Because the whole point of him is that in minute 20 with you, he's just getting started. So the whole notion that he would interview someone in 5 minutes and be done is ridiculous. It's not what he's about. What he's about is like extending the joke well past the point where, and that's his genius. And he's still mining this, like he was just talking about what it meant to be Irish when I did. And he's just going on and on, and each layer got funnier and funnier. Anyway.
Oh, well, I think we all know what we're doing tonight, right, everyone, when we get home. Conan's podcast. He owes you.
The Dana Carvey episode.
And the Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
I like Dana Carvey. So we'll have time for one more question here. And this is a good one from Marcia. What is the one important message we should take away about our interactions with strangers?
That the where I end up in the book is that once we understand just how bad we are at being strangers and how potentially problematic our mistakes with strangers can be, you know, it means that people get pulled over by cops and end up committing suicide. It means that Mendonox is 4 years in jail. It means we're taken in by Bernie Madoff, it means all these kinds of things, that we ought to be a lot more cautious and humble. We have to lose this kind of, we have a kind of inflated sense of our own ability in this area. We're hugely overconfident when it comes to the assessments we make of others. And I think we need to kind of address that and be a lot more, be a lot clearer about what we can and can't know about somebody. You know, like the classic example, you know, when they catch the serial killer and they interview the neighbors and they say, well, neighbor always says, oh, he seemed like such a quiet boy, right? And everyone's surprised. Well, why is it surprising to you that someone who is harboring a secret on the level of, I like to murder multiple people, would take great pains to hide that secret from you, their neighbor?
Yeah, right?
Like, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Like, the weird one would be the opposite. Would be like, oh, yeah, I gotta say, I always thought he was a serial killer. That was the first thing. He moved in next door, and I was, you know, I thought I was next. No, that's not the.
But if it doesn't get that extreme, obviously the other takeaway is that it makes us kinder. Like it would help us to not jump to a conclusion necessarily, as you said as well, right?
Yeah. It isn't, you know, there's a curious way in which being implicitly trusting in others without reservation and only abandoning that in the presence of overwhelming evidence, which is what I would like us to do, that is what makes empathy possible.
Because the thing about empathy is it's not conditional. And once you, the only way to be truly empathetic is to extend that act of moral generosity to everyone that you meet. And once you start picking and choosing who you want to be empathetic to, you're not empathetic, right? You're just playing favorites. And so it is only with when you have that kind of blanket position of trust in your fellow men and women that you're capable of being, of seeing the world through their eyes. And I think that's a kind of, that is the implicit lesson of a lot of religious teaching, right? It's the most beautiful thing in all of religious teaching, which is that everyone is worthy of our time and attention, and not just some people, not just your own people. That message could bear repeating right now in other parts of North America.
Yes. But if somebody has written a 3-volume manifesto and you're thinking about getting to know them, maybe read the manifesto.
Read the manifesto first.
Yes. Kindness, everyone, and read the manifesto.
Read the manifesto.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. You can find Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers wherever books or audiobooks are sold, including through the Vancouver Writers' Fest's Libro.fm store. To hear more events like this one, please visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.